Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. And once again, I am the bored man, my name being Graham Lee. Quick health update after episode 36, the isolation episode, in which I was suffering from the coronavirus COVID-19. I am mostly over that, although I have lost my sense of smell and taste. This is a surprising impact on your life, partly because you don't have that sort of guidance on what foods you need based on what tastes or smells are appealing, and partly because it sort of disrupts the sort of food preparation experience. You know, you don't have that sense of you're going to get something delightful or enjoyable out of spending time cooking food, and so it makes it a harder work to prepare a decent meal. It is a symptom that apparently goes away usually within a few weeks. So I'm looking forward to getting smell and taste back into my life. There are a certain sort of odours that I can very, very faintly detect if I'm fully embedded in them. Typically like none of my bathroom products smell of anything. Most of my sort of food and drink doesn't either. Anyway, that is an update on episode 36. On with episode 37, and the topic this time is systemic problems in software development. And what I mean by systemic problems is problems that aren't related to like the failure of any particular task in the software development lifecycle, or of any particular actor within a software organization, but are problems that are sort of introduced or amplified by the whole system itself. And so even if everybody is doing their work to the best of their abilities, the overall outcome, the software development, doesn't get better in particular ways, whether that's the cost of some development work, the time required to do some work, the quality of the outcome, or whatever. Everybody can be doing their job as defined as well as they are able, and that capability can be high, and yet the sort of set of rules and the set of interactions between people can cause the entire system to generate bad outcomes. Now, often we see those bad outcomes and we think, okay, we need to get better at our tasks. Developers, you need to get better at developing. Testers, you need to get better at testing. Product owners need to get better at owning products, whatever. Particularly in the development world, that tends to lead to a focus on tools and on internal development techniques, like changing the way that we do code review, changing the way that we write tests, changing the programming language that we use, changing the frameworks that we use. None of which, if the problem is systemic, is going to have any impact, because it isn't the work that we're doing or the work that anybody else particularly is doing that is holding the overall delivery of software back. It is the way in which all of these pieces of work are interacting. And so fixing these things is often the hardest part of improving a software organization, because it requires someone to have both a high enough view, like a high level enough view over the software organization to see that things are systemically going wrong. Enough of a sort of abstract model of the organization to to understand how to perturb the system in order to to shake it out of this sort of local minimum and into a better state. Enough political clout to be able to change enough different parts of the system in order to to cause that perturbation, and enough detailed view of each of those separate parts to see how their interaction is causing whatever sort of feedback cycle is leading to this poor systemic outcome. So typically in large organizations, you would have the situation where the people at the high level don't have any view on the sort of deep level work. And so just look at like high level metrics. Are we making enough money? We're making enough money to sort of carry on going. Therefore, there is no problem to be addressed. Unfortunately, they discover that there is a problem to be addressed only once the system's got so bad that it is no longer sustainable, at which point it needs a lot of correction to get back into a functioning state. And there are very few examples of that being successful. They do exist, but they are few and far between. And the people at the low level don't see the entire system and aren't motivated to make improvements to the entire system because their sort of evaluation and their criteria by which their work is measured have been subdivided so much that they are only focused on improving their own outputs and the activities that they perform, not their position in the entire system. And on smaller teams, it's often the case that the people can, in theory, sort of see across the whole system, but there's partly political factors at play, particularly on small organizations. They have an early programmer in the company who has become CTO by dint of being the longest serving engineer, and so isn't necessarily a very experienced developer or an experienced systems thinker, and certainly not an experienced C-suite executive, and so is not going to be someone who has the the sort of higher level abstract thinking of how the technology office fits into the rest of the organization, and isn't going to be particularly motivated by questions of how do technology and marketing work better together, because what they're trying to do is demonstrate that they should be in control of the technology office, right? That they have the they have the right to the job that they've landed in, which they think is about chiefing the technology office, not being the part of the chiefs that happens to have most influence over the technology. So this is a difficult problem at sort of every scale of business. What do we actually need to change about the entire system, and how do we do that, and who do we need to negotiate with in order to make that happen? What if a change that we need to make involves reducing the sort of localized metric of some task or of some division in order to improve the capability of the system as a whole? How do we produce that argument? How do we get that experiment done when we're basically saying, like, you need to be worse at your job? Not, that's not really what we're saying, but that's what it looks like. You need to do a lower sort of throughput on your job, or you need to dial back on these particular aspects of it so that it unlocks some capability in some other bit that will make the whole system better. How do we make that argument? What if doing our jobs better, what if just like improving my capability to write software, or the tester who is sat next to me, their ability to test the software, or the sort of systems group's ability to deploy it? What if improving any of those things, or even all three of those things, doesn't actually change the outcomes of our organisation? You know, what are we to do? Well, the first thing we need to do is to understand what typical systemic failures in software organisations are, and you know, use that as a model to see what are the things that may well be going wrong in this system that we're looking at, like, you know, in your business or your organization, and then, you know, what needs to change, because we can't sort of answer the political questions or the the particular sort of influencing questions, but we can answer what about the system needs to be mutated, which, you know, is the starting point to adapt knowledge of that mutation to the particular context of the organization that you're looking at. So let's sort of start lowball, and let's look at systemic failures in the before times, back when we were all doing sort of phased development in the waterfall times, which is, you know, like those of us who were doing phased development in the waterfall times knows that this is not strictly a true statement, though actually we were doing some iterative, some incremental work. But the, you know, by and large, we had much bigger projects, much bigger scope, much less frequent sort of checkpoints and evaluations, and particularly important to the systemic failures of these organizations, much less likelihood to change. Now, it's kind of ironic. The whole point of, like, the before times software engineering processes was to reduce risk, to increase control, like, by which I mean statistical process control, of the software development process to yield a higher chance of a successful outcome. But the way that this control was achieved led to a lot of rigidity and inflexibility, and so the opportunity costs were effectively ignored, despite the fact that they were great. You know, the idea was, we have to stay on our defined path because we understand this defined path and we understand what the outcomes are going to be, and therefore we have to put as many, like, blocks and obstacles as possible to veering off of that path. But that didn't allow for re-evaluation, and it didn't allow for discovery that another path was better, and it didn't allow for reaction to that understanding. So these things tended to be so inflexible that they introduced their own risks of lost opportunity and of wasted effort, and baked them in really hard to the process. So, for example, making it very difficult for customers to change projects, making it so difficult that the outcome of the project would by design be unsatisfactory to the customer. Now, the idea was, like, customers have all these sort of whimsical ideas about what they want software to do, and they're really capricious, they change their minds all the time, they don't really understand what software is or what it can do for them. And so if we allow them to change the project whenever they come up with a new idea, we will basically never be done, because we'll always be chasing their latest pipe dream. But the effect of not permitting that was that when the customer had, like, genuine changes in their needs, in, like, the competitive landscape, in like their line of business, in the thing that they were doing that motivated the software being constructed in the first place, the whole system was set up to ignore that. The developers couldn't, like, build a feature that supported this new thing because they weren't allowed. The analysts weren't allowed to, you know, go and write a specification for it or to gather detailed requirements for it. And then, you know, if no one had like written any requirements or written any software, then there was nothing to deploy and maintain later down the line. And so you ended up writing the wrong software. Similarly, internal changes made it it was similarly difficult to raise internal changes to the project. There was a great sort of political incentive to avoid doing it, because you didn't want to be the person who made the project late, even though you weren't making the project late, you were raising an issue. So, you know, let's take a real example. I was once involved in one of these projects, and I had a motorbike accident during the project. I was off work for 3 weeks, and then incapable of using both hands to operate the commuter for another 3 weeks, and which, you know, does slow you down. But, you know, the question, can we get this time back without having to implement a change control, was sort of asked, and, you know, schedules looked at and plans looked at, so that by the time it became clear that no, there is no way to make up for, you know, one third of the engineering team being away for 3 weeks without there being a consequence on the rest of the schedule, we need to raise this as a change control, or like file the change control request and go through that procedure with the entire project team and with the senior management and everything. By the time that happened, there was no way to to respond to this in any way other than by sort of moving out the entire project and by changing the resource allocation and then working out where people had already been allocated to other things and knock-on effects on other projects, and without causing a serious disruption to the business. You couldn't just say, okay, well, you know, Graham's out for 3 weeks, we will cut this feature out, or we will like ship with this thing and then do an update that has that thing in. You weren't allowed to make that call. Nobody was allowed to make that call. And so nobody would raise an amber flag, because nobody wanted to be the person who was who was to blame for the thing going wrong, even if raising an amber flag meant that it would be easy to correct. Therefore, nobody raised anything until it was like a deep crimson flag with sirens and flames and everything. And so you only found out about risks to the project once they had become unmanageable and uncontrollable. Those are two examples from as I said, from the before times back, and it's kind of important to understand that this sort of thing was going on in real software engineering companies, and like normal software engineering companies. Yeah, we're not just talking about like the defense companies. There's like this idea that you see in some books that, you know, software engineering as practiced in the before times has only really made sense for like, you know, massive US defense projects and IBM, and didn't really translate to anybody else. But no, like, you know, normal people were doing this. And as with like modern software projects today, they were having mediocre success. Like, you know, there were plenty of mediocre companies implementing mediocre processes and getting mediocre results that allowed them to maintain profit and stay in business back then. And the same is true now. There are plenty of mediocre companies who have a mediocre but agile, capital A, trademark process, and produce mediocre software and get mediocre results. We've never really been in crisis. We've been in disappointment for a number of decades. Anyway, so it's important to understand that like the motivations for agile software development were people seeing these things go wrong on projects and trying other things, and then finding that like those problems didn't exist on those other projects, and then promoting these other techniques as ways to avoid those problems that they had seen. Of course, just because you haven't seen some problems doesn't mean that there aren't other problems. And so there are still systemic failures in Agile Times projects and in, you know, projects that follow either the methodologies that were sort of popularized by the Agile Alliance, or following the principles and values that were espoused. Although I would probably suspect that those projects are actually few and far between. Most modern mediocre software organizations are actually, you know, following a prescribed process. It just happens to be a post-agile prescribed process. Anyway, the systemic failures these days tend not to be like, you know, out and out wasted effort that doesn't yield working software. They tend to be gradual slowdowns in the ability to produce working software, which is often manifested as less output per iteration, or more missed expectations per iteration, or reduced expectations per iteration. Is not usually manifested as longer iterations yielding the same results. So, you know, if I have my 2-week sprints, typically I'll go from like happy with the amount I get done in 2 weeks to unhappy with the amount I get done in 2 weeks, rather than going from happy with the amount I get done in 2 weeks to happy that I'm taking 4 weeks to get that much done, if you see what I mean. And like, there's a bunch of different systemic factors that can lead to this slower and more frustrating delivery on teams following like agile sort of process frameworks or methodologies, whatever you want to call them. Part seems to be a focus on user stories for a bunch of reasons. One is that user stories were introduced as sort of placeholders for conversations between all of the people involved on a project, including the customer, about what needed to happen for a particular thing that the customer wanted and valued. And they've been turned into a very lightweight, very poor specification format that is often divorced from anything that customers really want, because they're often sort of produced by a product owner who is, as we'll see later, thinking about sort of customers as an amorphous, average, statistical blob, not as people who have problems that need solving, and is putting ideas, whether well-formed or poorly formed ideas, putting ideas into their mouths in order to express them as things that they want an implementation team to go and implement. It's almost like, this is, I think, what really happens when you have an organization who has the technical people and the business, in quotes, within the same organization. Is effectively, they've built an agency development model within their own company. They've effectively insourced development to an internal but separate organization, and are throwing specifications across the boundary between the business, in scare quotes, and the delivery team. But user stories aren't a good way to throw specifications across the wall. Maths is a great way to do it, but maths is often inapplicable to the sorts of requirements that companies have, which are based on like interpersonal interactions. Interpersonal interactions are a great way to discuss these requirements, because they are the source form of the requirements. And actually, it turns out that, you know, fairly long prose documents can capture a lot more detail than very short user stories can. So like, there's a systemic problem there, in that, you know, if you say, okay, we're not getting many things done, product owner, you need to get better at prioritizing user stories, developers, you need to get better at implementing user stories, you're not fixing the fact that the user stories aren't a good description of what needs to happen on the software. And so nobody improving their work is going to make the system any better. Also, like, the people on the implementation side tend to see a prioritised list of things that need delivery and work from the top to the bottom. They don't get to see the big picture. They don't get to design things holistically. They don't get to understand how this thing is going to be used in context or in concert with everything else. And so that leads to it leads to a focus on implementation, which we'll come to later. But it also leads to very much greater rates of redesign, because you get to like story three and you realize that it's a sprouty thing off story one, and it's, you know, you now need the things that you built for story one to also do this thing. Whereas if you had built story one and three at the same time, then you would have got it done in the same amount of time that it took to build story one in the first place, or, you know, something along those lines. And so, you know, again, getting better at like delivering the work just means you get more of these, like, you know, redesign and rework things piling up in front of you, and so you slow down faster. And often it's the fact that there's like a presentation rather than a discussion that happens, and that is a thing that leads to the user stories being badly specified and lead to a lot of ambiguity. And so I've even seen large amounts of rework because a developer and a tester have understood the same ambiguous user story in different ways. And so the developer has built a thing which conforms to what is written in the user story. The product owner has written, by the way, a user story that conforms with what they think the product needs. And the tester has correctly rejected the implementation on the basis that it doesn't conform with their interpretation of the user story. And then rather than the three coming together and working out what should happen, the developer takes the test failures and changes it so that those tests pass. Maybe we go around that more than once. That can be quite frequent. And then the it passes QA, as it's called, even though there is no quality being assured in this process. It passes QA, gets to the product owner, who is taking on the customer proxy role of acceptance, and rejects it at that point because the thing that does some horrible like mismatch of what the developer thinks it should do and what the tester thinks it should do doesn't fulfill the expectations of the product owner, who has a different interpretation of what the story means. So any one of these things can lead to a situation where the system, the software development process itself, is getting in the way of the software development and is getting in the way of delivering valuable software to people, and that any one role or any one member of the team improving their capability to do their job, or even all of them improving their capabilities to do their jobs, doesn't result in an improved capability of the organization or of the team. Now, I said earlier that a thing that happens when you give your implementers a prioritized list of stories rather than a list of sort of, you know, goals that you are trying to achieve as an organization, is that they end up focusing on implementation, because you've effectively done an Adam Smith style division of labor between describing what needs to be done and doing it. And so the people on the implementation side are going to focus on doing it, even if problems related to the software delivery aren't related to their abilities to do it. So my goal when I'm on this kind of team, particularly the ones that have this like sort of fire break between the business and the technical team, whether that is a political fire break or a cultural fire break, whatever the cause of it, what tends to happen is that we are focused on how quickly can we get through this supposed backlog of stories, because it's usually faster to write a sentence that goes, as A, X, I want to Y so that I can Z, than it is to build the software that makes that thing happen. For whatever reason, whether that's design, whether it's coding, whether it's because your programmers are really poor typists, it's usually not that. But yeah, being a better typist does help you be a better programmer, but it usually isn't because it speeds up the implementation of the software. It's usually because it leaves you free to think about what you're doing rather than where each letter is on the keyboard. Anyway, if my job is to go through this supposed backlog and stop it growing by doing each of the things faster, then I'm going to basically optimize for local delivery. I'm going to optimize for what is the minimum effort involved to deliver this first story. Now, what is the minimum effort involved to deliver this second story? Now, what is the minimum effort involved to deliver this third story? I'm not going to focus on questions like, what is the most efficient way to deliver this capability that a customer wants, or this valuable addition to the software? I'm going to do it based on, how do I implement this? How do I implement that? And so shortcuts pile up in the software. I am deliberately using the phrase shortcut here, not technical debt. I think I've probably lost this argument even before I started having this argument, frankly. But in my opinion, technical debt is when you know that you are making a decision now that you are going to pay for later. Whereas shortcuts are just when you make a decision now because that is the appropriate decision to make, and it is the one that most quickly gets you to where you're trying to go. But each of these shortcuts has a cost associated with it in software development, and it's the fact that this cost was not deliberately factored in and traded off against alternatives that is what stops it to me being going into debt. If I go into debt, then what I'm saying is I can't afford this car or this house or this this whatever. Let's go with the car. I can't afford this car now because it costs £20,000, and I either don't have £20,000, or I do have £20,000, and I don't want to have zero at the end of this transaction. So what I will do is I will pay £28,000 over the next 3 years in order to get this car now. And I know that that's going to cost me more in the long run, but it's going to either enable a capability that I currently don't have, or it's going to improve my financial flexibility in a way that's important to me because it doesn't reduce my opportunity as much. I still have other money available now should I need it for other things. That kind of decision is often not made in software. When people talk about racking up technical debt, what they typically mean is, we found the cheapest way to build feature A, the cheapest way to build feature B, the cheapest way to build feature C, the cheapest way to build feature D, and now we've discovered that the cheapest way to build feature E is really expensive because we have to work around limitations in the software that are a result of building A, B, C, and D separately and in the cheapest ways possible. To me, that is a different thing than technical debt. But as I said, I've probably lost this argument. I'm still going to call it shortcuts. And you'll notice that the result of every shortcut is I do the fastest thing possible now, and I still do the fastest thing possible in the future, but the available things are nowhere near as fast as they were at the start, because I have to work out how to integrate them into this thing that doesn't particularly have a holistic design or architecture or even a holistic mode of operation. It is a collection of separate features that have each been designed separately and sort of sprouted onto the existing collection of features that was already there. So this goes back to what I was saying about user stories, that developers seeing the priority list of stories build the stories one at a time. They don't build the holistic sort of implementation of valuable capabilities for their customers. Now, another thing that happens is that organizations chase meaningless or vanity metrics. And this really is a systemic failure, because it points to the leadership either not knowing what the real metrics are, which, you know, does happen quite a lot. You know, they hear about the way that, like, an organization like Facebook maximizes time spent or number of users or something, and they choose to focus on the same things even though they are not Facebook, or their funders ask them to increase the number of signups or the user retention or something, and so they focus on those metrics, not on the, like, you know, the product values or the, like, you know, the thing about their offering that will drive those metrics. So they chase the, like, the lagging metrics. They don't chase the leading metrics, or don't even define the leading metrics, or don't even understand what the leading metrics might be. You know, I can't remember how many projects I've been asked to implement analytics on with that being, like, the description. You know, just drop in the analytics framework and get the dashboard up. You know, what are we measuring analytics for? What are they telling us? How do we want to use this information? What hypotheses are we building about how people are using our software? And, you know, what, how will this information confirm or refute those hypotheses? None of that exists. Just, okay, but, like, Google by default tells me page load and number of visitors. What do we need to do to get number of visitors up? We'll probably run some ads. We'll do that. What do we do to get page loads up? How about we implement some JavaScript that refreshes the page every so often? Like, yeah, yes, okay, we can improve those metrics, but that's not improving anything about the software. You know, it is at best neutral and at worst hostile. Yeah, definitely measuring things, if you don't have a theory of change about why, you know, changing this number yields better results for your business, is, like, you know, is at best a waste of time. So another vanity metric that you get is velocity, and I'm pretty sure I've talked about this on the podcast before, the idea that organizations get into sort of unsustainable paces by thinking that what they need to do is to increase the rate at which they implement software, when it may not be your ability to deliver software that is a question. It's your ability to specify what software needs to be delivered, or your ability to get the software into a condition where people are actually using it in valuable ways that needs to be improved. Often these things, as I said, come from a sort of top down from the funders, or from the leaders not understanding the metrics, and that in itself is often related to sort of growing businesses that work on a subscription or a software as a service model. You want to increase signups, so you focus on how do we get more people through the signup flow. Like, you know, how do we make it harder to use the software without signing up, but without turning people away? But then that doesn't sort of cover retention. That doesn't cover, do the people who sign up actually want to use this blooming thing afterwards? And so then we focus on retention, and we do that by making it harder for people to leave rather than by making the software more valuable so that they stay. And of course, maybe what we actually want to do when we're talking about increasing signups or retention is we want to improve revenue We can also do that by making the software more valuable so that people will pay more for it. You know, and then the same number of people being retained yields greater revenue. The same number of people signing up yields greater revenue. And increasing either of those, sign-ups or retentions, also yields greater revenue. So, you know, where do we fit that? Where do we fit making it more valuable into that thing if we're only chasing the vanity metrics of sign-ups and retentions? Again, things like reviews on app stores often are improved by like gaming, by finding out whether people are happy with the app and then offering them the review dialogue when we've ascertained that they are happy, or even in some cases masking the buttons for 1 to 3 stars so that the only way to get out of the dialogue is to press 4 or 5 stars. So, you know, proper dark user experience patterns, rather than by making the software better. But, you know, but that increases the overall systemic problems of like the whole software industry by perpetuating the idea that software is a lemon market and that none of it is worth paying for, because you cannot trust any like high scoring or highly reviewed software to actually be any good. And this is not so much a systemic failure. This is usually a localized failure that is caused by the previously described systemic failures. The ways that developers think about how do we improve our capability is often additive. It's often we can do this thing that we are not already doing, but that needs to be thought of in terms of opportunity costs. You know, we can integrate this new programming language that is supposedly way better than whatever we're currently using because it's newer, and newer means better is one example. Well, if we do that, then we're going to have to change the way that our software is built and deployed so that we are able to build and deploy using this new language, this new set of tools. That stops us from doing something else, because, you know, just because we've got finite resources and we're spending them on doing that thing. But worse is like the additive way in which the developer process grows, the accretion of new steps or tools, which ultimately serves to slow down development and to make it harder to, you know, get into that sort of software development mindset where you are like implementing at the speed of thought, because you're not implementing at the speed of thought, you're implementing at the speed of your CI pipeline, and you're, you know, waiting, you're having to task switch or go and check mail or do social media while this ever increasing number of steps involved in the implementation happens on some remote computer, you know, on the build farm or whatever. So it's always easier to argue for adding another like code review, you know, something for people to look for in code review, to add more tests to the CI system, to add another like lint step or more rules to the lint step, another like analysis round to the build process, whatever. It's always easier to argue for more of those things than for removing them, even if what is going wrong is that you are missing out on too many opportunities because it takes too long to do the things that you are currently doing. There's very rarely a discussion. I've worked on teams where you can rely on a number of hours between submitting a you know, potential change to the build system and getting the what is considered the minimal amount of information from the continuous integration for it to be integrated. Hours to get told, yes, you are allowed to integrate. That is not continuous integration because nobody is integrating. People are putting off integration because they know they're not going to get anything done for 3 hours between putting the candidate up and even getting the automated response that means that anybody else is going to code review it. That is the opposite of continuous integration. That is siloed development because, like, people work on their own branch, work locally until they are pretty sure that what they have got is A, going to go through the implementation, the integration machinery, and B, only have to go through it once. And so you end up with continuous isolation. Anyway, I've worked, you know, on a team where it was in that condition, and it took hours to get anything done, and you still weren't allowed to say, well, why don't we remove that test set that is giving us any value? You know, nobody is ever looking at the results of those tests. Those tests have not failed in any run in the last 28 days. Why don't we just delete them and rely on other signal to know whether that passes? No, you're not allowed to do that because that introduces risk. But what risks does it remove by removing those things? You know, what more do we get? What faster process, what greater collaboration do we get by not having that we are missing out on by keeping the time it takes to get that signal in our system? So what I'm arguing for is sort of taking a step back from your day-to-day work, you know, not asking what do I need to change about the way that I work in order for me to be a better developer. I'm arguing for saying, what do we need to change about the way in which we think about, plan and execute the business of implementing software that our customers find valuable or that our users find useful, whatever your context is, such that we do a better job at that overall. What needs to change about the organization in order to make a better software design and delivery organization, rather than what do I need to do in order to fail my bit of the process faster? If you found any sort of systemic failures in your organizations that I haven't been talking about, I'd be really interested to hear about those. If you've got examples of ways in which you have successfully negotiated for those kinds of systemic changes, that'd be really interesting and useful for the rest of SICPA's community. So I'd love to hear about those as well. You can always email me, grahamlee@acm.org. You can find me on Twitter, IWasLeeG. You can probably find me in some other places as well. I hope you're all doing well, and I will talk to you again soon.